Thanks. How about that? See, got me all maxed up now. Matthew chapter 6. Tonight, we're going to continue through, obviously, with the Sermon on the Mount. Chapter 5, 6, and 7 are that Sermon on the Mount. So in chapter 6, we've been through chapter 5, and I wanted to get through chapter 5 last week, so we were a little long last week, and got the rest of the way through chapter 5 and sort of dealt with how Jesus Christ was going back under the law. And this sort of carries over into chapter 6 too, so we'll talk about it a little bit tonight by way of review, then bring it right on into chapter 6. When you get into chapter 6, he continues on this theme of the internal righteousness, that what the kingdom requires is not just that external fair show in the flesh that you could do with the law, but it requires the internal righteousness. If you look, for example, in chapter 6, verse 1, take heed that ye do not your alms before men to be seen of them, otherwise you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Down in verse 5, and when thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are, for they love to stand praying in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. But I say to you, verily I say to you, they have their reward. And then if you look over in verse 16, moreover, when ye fast, be not as the hypocrites of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces, that they may appear unto men to fast. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. So in chapter 6 here, he's sort of continuing that theme, that the issue in the kingdom is going to be an internal righteousness. When you do alms, it's not to be seen of men. It has to be something that's coming from inside. When you pray, it's not to be seen of men. It's coming from inside. And when you fast, it's not to be seen of men. It's to be something that's coming from inside. It can be done totally alone by yourself. And it's not an issue of showing something in the flesh. It's having that real righteousness within you. And if you go back to chapter 5, we sort of started that theme way back when we finished the Beatitudes and got into the next section of the Sermon on the Mount there, where he says in verse 17, think not that I'm come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and teach men so shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven. So the theme starting right there when he starts talking about the law, I didn't come to destroy the law or the prophets, I came to fulfill them. And he starts talking about, I'll kind of try to draw it up here. Does that look like the Ten Commandments, the tables of the law? That's the law.
No, when you first started that, I thought you were drawing a flat.
Mine's totally places they ought not to be, I'll tell you. It could be, but. And then, okay, now, how about this? There, can you tell what that is? Okay.
I thought you were originally wrong.
A heart. See, now that's a good righteous thought, not an evil, lascivious thought, you know. Keith got right to the truth. Looks like a butt to me, and then Tammy. All right, so the issue is that instead of the law being written on tables of stone, he's going to write the law in their hearts. And when we started through this section, we went back and looked at the Old Testament passages that make that promise. I'll write the law in your heart, write it in your inward part. I shall be your God, you will be my people. All of those verses are verses that deal with this kingdom time. And what Jesus Christ is doing in Matthew chapter 5 is demonstrating that. Here's what that means. Here's what those Old Testament prophecies mean. Here's how they're going to be fulfilled for you as you enter out into the kingdom. As we came through the last part of chapter 5, he is just reinforcing that. He's going back to the law and getting specific commandments out of the law. And for instance, in verse 21, you have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill. Verse 22, but I send you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. Down in verse 27, you have heard that was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say unto you. Verse 33, again, you have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, Verse 34, but I say unto you. Verse 38, ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say unto you. Verse 43, ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thy enemy, but I say unto you. And every time he does that, what he's doing is not eliminating the law. When he says, but I say unto you, he's not saying, I'm replacing the law with some new commandment. What he's doing is saying, here's the way the law was given when it was written in tables of stone, but I say to you, here's the way that same law and that same principle is going to operate when it's written in your heart. You know, the one about, you've heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. I say unto you that if a man look upon a woman to lust after her in his heart, he hath committed adultery with her already. That's maybe the clearest example that you can see, because he uses in there the word heart. And he's not eliminating the law. He's not saying the commandment forbidding adultery is done away with. But what he is saying is that commandment about adultery now has become an issue that's written on your heart. And it's got to be an internal righteousness, not just an external righteousness. If you remember, he said in chapter 5 there, except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And if you just keep your hand here in Matthew, because we'll be right back to Matthew 6. But over in Matthew 23, we've used this passage several times in this comparison. The righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was an external one. Verse 23 of Matthew 23, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Ye may pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin. If omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith, these ought you to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! And here's the key. Ye may clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. So when he says, except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, what he's saying is, it's not enough just to make the outside of the cup and the platter clean. You have to cleanse first that which is within. You have to have this law written in your heart, in your inward parts. Now that will be demonstrated in living it out. We looked at the passages, you know, in 1 John chapter 3, if you're born of God, you cannot sin, you will not commit sin. All of those passages are about that time period. And so he's not saying it's going to be only in your heart, but it will originate in your heart. And when it originates in your heart, it will live out in your body of flesh, but it will be more than just written on tables of stone. It'll now be written in your heart, in your inward parts, and live out through your body of flesh. Now when you get to chapter 6, and let's go back there to chapter 6, he's going to continue that same thought and that same emphasis in the first part of chapter 6 here. And we'll just read the first part of those three sections that I talked about earlier and see how in each place he's simply taking another illustration from the law and talking about how the kingdom will affect that. And how practicing the law in the kingdom becomes an issue of the heart, not just an issue of the flesh, and keeping a law written on tables of stone. Chapter 6, verse 1. Take heed that ye do not your alms before men, to be seen of them. Otherwise ye have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But when thou doest alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth. When you do alms, you do them in secret. You don't, verse 2, you don't sound the trumpet before thee as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets. And when you think about that, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues, and who are the hypocrites in the synagogues that do it that way? The scribes and Pharisees. We just read about them. I mean, in that chapter, when we went through it the last couple of weeks, you know, time after time, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. Well, here he's saying, and all through chapter 5 there, remember, that was sort of one of the themes that sort of was running through there. Don't be like the scribes. They're doing this outward, visible performance of the law, but within they're full of extortion and excess. Don't be that way. That theme continues in chapter 6. The scribes and Pharisees, they have that outward show. They're hypocrites. They do it in the synagogues and in the streets. They do it to have the glory of men. I say to you, don't do it that way. Keep your hand here in Matthew and turn over to Mark chapter 12. Mark chapter 12. And verse number 38. Mark chapter 12 and verse number 38. And here's the account. This is, you know, when we talk about when you do alms, or sometimes that's reference to giving alms. Doesn't have to be, but oftentimes it is. There's the parable about the widow's mite that I'm sure you've all heard. And it's not necessarily directly about that, but you can certainly see some indication there. If you start in verse 38 of Mark chapter chapter 12, "And he said unto them in his doctrine, Beware of the scribes, which love to go in long clothing and love salutations in the marketplaces, and the chief seats in the synagogues, and the uppermost rooms at feasts, which devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. These shall receive greater damnation. And Jesus sat over against the treasury, and beheld how the people cast money into the treasury. And many that were rich cast in much. And there came a certain poor widow, and she threw in two mites, which make a farthing. And he called unto him his disciples, and saith unto them, Verily I say unto you, this poor widow hath cast more in than all they which have cast into the treasury. For all they did cast in of their abundance, but she of her want did cast in all that she had, even all her living." Now, you know, the direct reference there is about, you know, giving much opposed to giving little and giving all you have and that sort of thing. But clearly, too, he's talking about the scribes and the Pharisees, the chief seats in the synagogues and all of that, and how they do it to be seen of men. And these people, in verse 41, they cast money into the treasury, and many that were rich cast in much. Well, they're clearly doing that to be seen of men. They want people to see them put that money into the treasury. And Christ says, that's not, back to chapter 6, that's not the issue. You need to do it. You need to do it out of a pure heart, not as the hypocrites do, not just to be seen of men, not to make a fair show in the flesh, but because your heart is really changed and transformed because I've written my law in your inward parts. In verse 5, he takes the same principle and applies it to prayer. When thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. You know, and I always think of that verse. Did you ever see pictures of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem? It's still there, one of the walls of the city. And you see the guys out there, you know, doing this thing before the wall and all that. You know, and I think about that verse. They love to do it standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. And, you know, people come from all over the world just to see people praying at that Wailing Wall. Well, you know, so what's going on today in Judaism is not all that different than what was going on back here. Verse 6, "But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou shut thy door, pray to thy Father which is in secret, and thy Father which is in secret shall reward thee openly." So he talks about when you pray, you do it in secret. Go to Luke 18. Luke 18 is probably the classic passage about the hypocritical prayer and the honest, sincere, humble prayer in the Gospels. Luke 18 and verse 9. "And he spake this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a publican. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the publican, standing afar off, would not lift up so much as his eyes to heaven, but smote upon his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other, for everyone that exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted. Again, the idea is, if you're doing these prayers, making these prayers, long prayers for pretense and to be seen of men, then in the kingdom, that's not going to cut it. You know, in the system they're living under right here, that looks pretty good. The scribes and the Pharisees get all this acclaim and all this adoration and all this praise of the people. But he's telling his disciples, in the kingdom, that won't... Remember the context of this whole thing. He's taking his disciples away into a mountain, and he's instructing them. He's not telling the scribes and Pharisees this stuff. He's not telling the multitudes this stuff. He's taken his followers, he's taken the disciples away into the mountain, and he's instructing them. And he's making clear, sure that they understand, you see the leadership in the nation now. You are going to be the new leaders of the nation. And when you are the new leaders of the nation, you ought not to be leading the way they are. You see the way they're doing it? Here's the way you need to do it. They make prayers for a pretense. They stand in the synagogues, in the corners of the streets. When you do it in secret. Because you need to have a righteousness that's of the heart, not outwardly in the flesh. Down to verse 16, we're going to come back to what we're skipping there, the Lord's Prayer. But down to verse 16, moreover, when ye fast, be not as the hypocrites of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces, that they may appear unto men to fast. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. And in each of these cases, he's saying, if you've done it to be seen of men, once they see you, you have your reward. They saw you praying, or they saw you giving, or they saw you real nice and skinny and drawn because you've been fasting. And there's an interesting passage. Go back to the book of Daniel. Jonathan Burney probably just went through this in the class about what Daniel and his cohorts did back here in Nebuchadnezzar's court. The idea is, when ye fast, be not as the hypocrites of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear unto men to fast. In other words, if I'm going to fast, I want to look good and hungry and miserable while I'm doing it, so that everybody will say, boy, you look miserable, you must be fasting. You know. So, and he's saying, that's not the way to do it. Back in Daniel is probably the best illustration of how to do it properly. And this is just kind of an interesting little incident that happens here. Daniel chapter 1, verse 5, the king appointed them. This is when King Nebuchadnezzar takes the Jews captive. And in verse 4, verse 3, the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in wisdom, cunning in knowledge, understanding science, such as had the ability in them to stand in the king's palace, whom he might teach the learning in the tongue of the Chaldeans. He's going to take the best and the brightest in Israel, bring them into his palace, and instruct them in the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Teach them his language, teach them the learning of the Chaldeans, and make them a part of his kingdom. Verse 5, part of that is, the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat, and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. For he gave unto Daniel the name of Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, to Azariah Abednego. And that's those last three, that's the names that we more commonly know them about, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which the king drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Now, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are going to eat the king's meat and drink the king's drink. The king's meat and the king's drink offered in sacrifice probably to idols, to his pagan gods. Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah say, we're not going to do that. We're not going to participate in the king's religious hoodly-doo that he does with his food. We're just not going to be a part of that. We don't want the king's meat. We don't want anything from him. He's not our real king. We're captive here. He's not our king. So we don't want any. The prince of the eunuchs has an answer, verse 10. The prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. So the problem that the prince of the eunuchs has is, if you don't eat this stuff, you're not going to look as healthy as you ought to look, like the other ones that are eating it, and you'll endanger my head. I'll be in trouble because he picked out the best and the brightest, told me to take good care of you, give you the very best of everything, and if you don't eat it, it's going to be my head on the chopping block. Verse 11. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented to them in this matter, and proved them 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which had eaten the portion of the king's meat. And Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. So we don't want to eat the king's meat. We're going to eat pulse, you know, like cream of wheat or oatmeal or something really, blah, you know, that's what we're going to eat. And water, that's all. We today might say bread and water. I just want bread and water. And the objection is, well, you're not going to thrive very well on that, and so the king's going to see that. He's going to be mad at me. He'll have my head. Daniel said, well, you just see how well we thrive on it. Now, they had to eat a lot of this barfy taste and pulse to they're getting fat. In 10 days, they're getting fat. So they're eating a lot of this stuff. The point is, they're not doing what that refusal to take the king's meat is not so that they can stand before the king looking all haggard and thin and malnourished and say, see, king, we're making a statement. We're not going to eat your meat. They did it. The king never knew, because they looked as healthy as all the others, healthier than all the others, in fact. The king never knew. They did it out of a pure heart. And in Matthew chapter 6, he's making the point, if you fast to be seen of men, so that you will look all haggard and malnourished before men, then that's not it. You need to not do that. You need to not fast before men, or fast so that you look that way before men. And so again, it gets back to the issue of your heart, your heart, your heart, your heart. You don't disfigure your face that you appear unto men to fast. If you're fasting, nobody should know it but you, because it's a heart issue, not just tables of stone anymore. Now, keep your hand there in Matthew 6 and go to Matthew 23. That chapter that we looked at so much about the scribes and the Pharisees, in each one of these cases, he says, they do this to be seen of men. The giving of alms, the praying, the fasting, to be seen of men. That takes you right back to the scribes and the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 23, verse 1. Then spake Jesus to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But do not ye after their works, for they say and do not. They bind heavy burdens, grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. For all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries, enlarge the borders of their garments, love the uppermost rooms at feasts, chief seats in the synagogues, greetings in the markets, and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. Verse 5, all their works they do for to be seen of men. That's a problem. That's not the reason they're supposed to be doing it. And when the law is written in your heart, that's not the reason you'll do it. And there's another very practical issue here. These are principles that are going to be in effect in the kingdom. But they are, but what does Israel have to, before they get out here to the kingdom, what are they going to go through in here? The testing, the 70th week. If you are serving the Lord, truly serving the Lord in the 70th week, how will you have to serve Him? In secret. Because if you're serving Him, you know, if you're standing in the street corner praying to Jehovah God, the true God, and not to Antichrist, you're going to have a real short lifespan. So, I mean, there's two things going on here. One is, the kingdom requires this to be a hard issue. So when you're leading in the kingdom, you're not going to be like the scribes and Pharisees. You're going to be leading on a very different basis. But also, you know, when you're in this 70th week, everything you do, even though this that's in your heart will work out in your flesh, you can't, you're not going to be out there in the street corners doing this stuff. You're not going to be doing even what limited freedom they had in this case without the persecution of the Jews will be even less out here in the 70th week, because you're going to be doing everything in secret then. So there's kind of a double meaning, and we'll see some of that when we look at the Lord's Prayer here at how that kind of works in with it. Any questions about the idea of the internal? I mean, a lot of chapter 6, the first part of it here, is sort of just continuing the idea back in chapter 5. Take the law from an external to an internal. It's got to be in your heart. You don't do it to be seen of men. You do it because your heart is pure before the Lord. Right. I think the instruction is because, see what's the right way to say this. If you come by faith, how can I say this? There are going to be people that are doing this, okay? There are going to be people in the tribulation period, not so much when you get into the kingdom, but when you in the tribulation period and even out in the kingdom, there will be people that are keeping the law in the flesh the same way that the scribes and Pharisees kept it. There will be people that are keeping the law because it's written in their inward parts, the ones that are getting the instruction here. The way you know the difference in Israel is the ones that are just keeping it outwardly in the flesh are not the true Jews. The ones that keep it in the heart are the true Jews. And I think what he's doing here is giving this is how you would identify a true Jew. This is how you would identify one that has it written in his heart. It's somewhat for the purpose of how do you identify these people that have the law written in their inward parts. They're not going to be the ones that are making prayers in the street and doing like the scribes and Pharisees. They're going to be the ones that are like Daniel and the widow's mite and like that. So it is instruction to them, but it's not so much you have to do this, and I guess I kind of said it that way, as here's what will distinguish you from the nation that'll be still going on trying to keep that law. The Antichrist is not going to do away with the law. He's just going to say, I'm the Messiah that the law promised. But it'll all be a fair show in the flesh. And what's going to distinguish the true nation is it'll be written in their heart. And that's how they'll know the difference. He's given the instruction here. Those that have it written in their heart, here's how they'll do it. Those that have it in their, just doing a fair show in the flesh, they do it the way the scribes and Pharisees do it. Okay? It's to identify. It's sort of like in 1 John when he says, they that are born of God cannot sin. Well, yeah, they cannot sin, but that's given as an instruction. You see somebody out there sinning, you know what that means? He's not born of God. If he doesn't love his brother, you know what that means? He's not born of God. If he's still keeping the law as a fair show in the flesh, he's not born of God, because you'll have it written in your inward parts. Okay? Okay.
If we relate all of this
Yeah.
But I understand, or I can see clearly how in grace Paul addresses all these issues of giving of your alms, you know, prayer, and how they're different for us, or how we approach them differently in grace.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that I don't seem to catch is fasting.
Yeah.
Because Paul does, he mentions it really, as far as I know, only at one place in 1 Corinthians 7.
Right.
You know, how is it that that is still, though, carried over into the dispensation of grace? Because he is mentioning, you know, hey, husbands, wives, don't defraud one another except for
right.
fasting and prayer.
Right, right.
How is it that that's carried over? You know, how did that get carried over?
Well, in a sense, all these things are carried over in that, you know, is giving of alms carried over? Well, are we instructed to give? Yes, we are. Is the prayer carried over? It is. We're instructed to pray. Is fasting carried over? You know, you could say, is that an instruction to fast in 1 Corinthians 7? It's probably not. And actually, if you look at fasting, we're not supposed to teach about fasting tonight, but says Jonathan, that's all right, that's fine. Fasting is never really something in the Bible that is command, you need to fast. Fasting is more something that happens when you are so involved with something. Did you ever hear somebody say, I was working on this project and I got so engrossed in this project that I forgot to eat. Did everybody say anything like that? I forgot to eat because I was just so... And when the Bible talks about fasting, it's not like when Jesus Christ went out for 40 days and fasted in the wilderness and all of that. It's not so much that Jesus Christ said, well, I think I need to take 40 days and not eat anything. It's that Jesus Christ went out into the wilderness to contemplate some things and to do some things and became so engrossed and involved in that that food was just the furthest thing from his mind. And I think that's the way Paul says it when he talks about don't defraud your spouse except for a time for prayer and fasting. If you become so engrossed in prayer and fasting in spiritual issues that everything else has just gone away, then okay, that's fine. But it's not a religious, I'm not explaining it well. It's not a religious, legalistic, okay, I'm going to start fasting today and I'm going to fast like the Muslims do, for example. I'm going to start fasting today, and I'm going to fast for this long. And we're going to have all these exceptions to fasting. Like if you're old or young or sick or pregnant, you don't have to fast. Well, that's just a legalistic kind of fasting. Fasting, the way the Bible talks about it, is I'm so engrossed in something, usually a spiritual issue, that I have no interest in eating or in drinking or in anything. I'm just engrossed in this thing. So, and that would be fasting that comes out of a pure heart. You know, so all of those things, and really, I think one of the reasons why the Sermon on the Mount gets used so much are the verses like this. Because if you look at these verses, does Paul tell us that the righteousness you have, where does he tell you your righteousness is? It's in Christ, but is it in the flesh or internal? It's in the spirit. It's an internal thing. You're righteous on the inside, and the righteousness of Christ and the life of Christ lives out through you. Well, that's what Christ is telling them they need to have in the new covenant, and they're going to get in the new covenant. So there's a similarity between the idea that in the new covenant, Israel's going to get that law written in their inward parts and they'll have righteousness. We have righteousness today. Not based on the covenants, not based on being part of Israel, not based on any of that, but we have righteousness today. So a lot of these things that you read in the Sermon on the Mount, when he starts taking the law from an external issue to an internal issue, you look at those and you say, well, that sounds like what we have. You know, I don't want you to give to be seen of man. I want you to give out of a pure heart. Well, what's Paul say to the Corinthians? He says, as a man purposeth in his heart, he needs to give. I don't want you to pray just to be seen of men. Well, you know, what does Paul say? Let your request be made known. Well, glad you could show up. Let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds. So, you know, there's similarities between what Christ instructs here in the Sermon on the Mount and what Paul instructs in the dispensation of grace. The similarities are because both deal with an internal righteousness. The way you get it, why you have it, all of that is different, but they both deal with an internal righteousness. And maybe I'm not even coming close to answering your question. I kind of went a long way off the... We're driving to Chicago Friday. I'll have 12 hours. Yeah. No, that's all right. No, go ahead. I was just kidding. That's okay.
I didn't see in the law, and I'm obviously don't know the law, but that's
positive. You've forgotten some of it.
When thou prayest, you know, when thou give alms, you know, when ye fast. I never understood that those things were part of the thou shalt.
Okay.
You know, because he does say when you pray.
Right.
When you give alms, when you fast, not hey, you have to, you have to, you have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when we come to the issue of, you know, these things in the heart, in this dispensation of grace, we give, for instance, a purpose in our heart. We pray, you know, for a whole different reason or purpose.
Right.
In the inner man.
Right, right.
But then all of a sudden there was this fasting thing. And I'm like, well, where does that connect to that?
Yeah.
Whether it is the law or not the law, or is it grace, not grace?
Yeah.
Or does it connect in either one?
Yeah. Fasting to me... Anytime I've studied it, and you're right, it's not one of those things where you see thou shalt fast, except when there would be a fast day, for instance, the Day of Atonement. You will fast and you will do no servile work because I want you to afflict your souls. Even in that case, I mean, there is a law that says you're going to fast today, but what's the purpose of the fasting? Because I want you to afflict your souls. I want you to think about something else. I want you to think about your sin. So fasting is always, I want you to be focused on this spiritual issue so strongly that you don't even want to eat. And I think when Paul uses it there in 1 Corinthians 7, it's clearly that. I've given myself to prayer and fasting. I've given myself to spiritual things. And that's why I don't want my wife around, because I've given myself totally spiritual things for a while here. That's what he's saying in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. But he's not saying, I'm going to make a legalistic thing of this. And on the, you know, every month that has five Sundays, you know, from midnight at such and such a day till, you know, midnight at such another day, I'm going to fast. That's not it. It's that I've so committed myself to this thing that I'm focused on that.
Mm-hmm. Or done from the heart, are really going to be no differently done than as we ought to be walking today. Right,
right. And that's pretty true statement. I mean, there the difference is if they're written in your heart, and I will cause you to keep them. Yeah, but you did say in what we ought to be doing today, and that's the word to use. He's going to cause them to do what the law required them to do. We are given the ability to do righteousness, to live the life of Christ, but we're not caused to do it. But we are given the ability to, because our flesh has been crucified, which they didn't have under the law, that ability, because their flesh is not crucified.
So that means they don't have the sin nature once he caused them.
I don't believe they do, no. I believe the sin nature goes with the curse. He's going to remove the curse from the earth when the kingdom comes. And that at least those that are in his kingdom will have that sin nature removed. Now we saw last week or a couple weeks ago or whenever, there's going to be a lot of people living on the earth. The nations are going to live on the earth still and be evangelized, not here in the 70th week, but be evangelized in the kingdom. And that evangelization that goes on in the kingdom, yeah, that was last week we talked about that, wasn't it? I don't know. 2 weeks ago. Anyhow. Because I remember you asked the question, Tammy. That's why I looked at you, because I thought you might remember that the kingdom is for the evangelization, yeah, whatever that is. The preaching of the gospel of the kingdom to the Gentiles will come in the kingdom. So those ones that are in the kingdom, they will have the law written in their parts. They will have their sin nature removed. But those people, those Gentile nations that they're preaching to will not. So there will still could be sin in the kingdom out in those Gentile nations, but not in the nation that has come to Christ. What started off as the little flock, but by that time will be the nation. There will not be sin there. Well, that's a good question. What do you think, Keith?
Now, they'll be born on men because it says, you know, you will die a child at 100 years.
Right.
If you're yeah. This way. So,
but a sinner being 100 years old, he shall die. Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, you're going to, if they don't come to the same
faith
as their parents, you know, you're not given a free ride by bloodline.
They can still sin. Yeah.
You're given a free ride by faith.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
The remnant will have the sin nature.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, wait a minute. In the kingdom, all Israel will not be the remnant.
All Israel will not be the remnant. No.
So you'll have still Israel and the remnant in the stream of the remnant.
Yeah. Most of Israel will be destroyed at his return, the false Israel, because they will have followed Antichrist. And Antichrist and the nations that followed him will be destroyed. And one of the nations that followed him is the unbelieving national Israel. Unbelieving national Israel will have followed him. So they'll be destroyed. The nations that will survive and go out into the kingdom are those Matthew 25 nations. I gave you water, I gave you food, you know, when did we do that? As much you've done, one of these things, my brother, you've done unto me, all of that. So they're the ones that go out into the kingdom. The nations that joined Antichrist, including Israel, will be destroyed at his return. Yeah. That will go out into the kingdom. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's why we need to bless Israel. That's right. By all means, we need to bless Israel because we want to get in that kingdom. Hallelujah. Anything else? We're gonna quit here instead of starting into the Lord's Prayer. Is what we'll just go through that next week.
Can you just keep going on that? So the fact that they're not Jews, but they're going into the kingdom, doesn't mean that they're going to be saved.
No, does not mean they're going to be saved. They, in fact, the individuals that go into the kingdom might have had nothing to do with why they're there. They're in that nation, remember. See, and one reason it's hard for us to think in these terms, because we don't think in these terms today at all. We think everything today individually. You believe, I believe, Jonathan believes, you know, we believe as an individual. Getting into the kingdom is based on what did your national leadership do? If the leaders of your nation supported that remnant, then your nation goes into the kingdom. You might be a godless reprobate, but your nation gets into the kingdom. Just like oftentimes you look at the history of Israel, if the leaders of the nation led that nation astray and disobeyed God, judgment would come on the nation. Even though there were godly people in the nation, judgment came. On the other hand, if there were righteous leaders, blessing came. Now that doesn't mean every person down to the lowest little whatever, was a godly person in Israel. There were always reprobates in the nation. But if the leaders followed God, they got the blessing with the nation because God dealt with them as national entities. And he will again deal with them as national entities when he got into the kingdom. That's totally foreign to our way of thinking today, and it's hard for us to imagine, well, I'll get into the kingdom because George Bush did something or didn't do something. That's just contrary to the way we think about God dealing with us. But that is the way it'll function then. Keith, go ahead.
In Revelation 24, where it says, I saw thrones and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Christ and for the word of God, which did not worship and so on and so on. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years, and then they fought. are dead and resurrected.
Yeah.
It's not
the ones that live and go right out into the kingdom. Right.
And so basically it's just the last final way of showing, God's
right.
Different ways so that giving man a chance to succeed, and this is the last best hope, and man fails. Again.
Right. And interestingly, tying what Keith said, the people that fail in that scenario, because he's right, the kingdom, every dispensation, every time God dealt with man, it ended in failure. I wouldn't call them all dispensations, but he put Adam and Eve in the garden. That failed. He gave Israel the law. That failed. He gave us grace. That's going to fail. He establishes a kingdom, which will fail. But the people that will fail, down in verse 8, when Satan is loosed out of his prison, they should go out to deceive the, what? Nations, which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, gathered into the battle. So, those nations out there that Israel is evangelizing. So you've got this, you got, like Keith said, you got God sitting on the throne on planet Earth with a whole nation of righteous Jews evangelizing those Gentile nations for 1,000 years. And at the end of the 1,000 years, how much good has the evangelism done? As soon as Satan is released out of the pit, the nations go right back. You know, the remnant won't, that nation, those resurrected ones and all that, to go, they won't go back, but the nations that they evangelized in the kingdom, they go right back to Satan, right back to him. So yeah, and Keith's point is right. It's another demonstration of the depravity of man, that after 1,000 years of that righteous reign, where do the Gentiles go? Right back to Satan again, right back to him. Anything else? Thank you for the precipitation in tonight's. Yes, well, we really went the long way around the bush there. We got somewhere. I don't know. Because we were wandering the wilderness for a long time, so I hope we got somewhere. All right, let's have a word of prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Our God and Father, again, we do thank you for Jesus Christ and for the opportunity of looking to your word this evening and studying it together. And as we've done so, we pray that the things said and done are brought honor and glory to the name of Christ, for it's in his name that we pray. Amen.